This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak about the tremendous repression being carried out against those on campuses speaking out in support of Palestinians.
Professor Alan Wald from the University of Michigan discusses how this is all too reminiscent of the McCarthy era and what it means for academic freedom in America today.
Also on Law and Disorder, we speak to the author of the new book, Homeland Security, Myths and Monsters, about the Department of Homeland Security and what it's doing.
We speak with author Arun Kundnani, who talks about how the Department of Homeland Security has become a repressive and bloated manifestation of government agencies.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild. All across this country, academic freedom is once again under severe attack. Why? Because at colleges and universities, professors who dare to speak out in defense of the Palestinian people and condemn Israel's genocidal war against the Palestinian people are being censored, disciplined, and fired. And these attacks on academic freedom are not limited to actions by university administrators, but include those by the federal government as well. Visiting scholars, adjuncts, and lecturers without tenure have also had their contracts terminated or not renewed. Some had their classes suddenly canceled. Faculty members who espouse views contrary to official U.S. policy vis-a-vis the Israeli-U.S. war in Palestine have been criticized in ways that have trampled on their reputations and hurt their careers. As an excuse for this present-day McCarthyism, college and university administrators often claim their censorious actions are undertaken only on behalf of ensuring their Jewish students feel safe on campus. But there is a distinct lack of evidence to support their claimed motivation. And in fact, the largest pro-Palestinian actions on campuses are generally organized by Jewish groups, such as Jewish Voice for Peace. So today we've invited a professor from the University of Michigan to join us. We'll ask him about McCarthy-styled witch hunts against academic personnel, both in the past and again today. We'll learn how federal law is being misused as a mechanism of political repression against academia. And we'll discuss the role that controversy over slogans condemning Zionism play in this new attack on academic freedom, and what strategies are best employed today by the anti-war movement in the fight back against these attacks as the ever more deadly Israeli-U.S. war in Palestine continues. Our guest today is Professor Alan Wald, the H. Chandler Davis Collegiate Professor Emeritus at the University of Michigan, which I might add is my alma mater. Professor Wald has authored 8 books related to today's topic. He has been a socialist scholar since the 1960s and is currently an editor of the journal Against the Current, as well as a member of the editorial board of Science and Society. And Professor Wald was a founder of University of Michigan's Faculty and Staff for Justice in Palestine Committee. Well, Alan Wald, a warm, warm welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks. I'm happy to be here.
I stated in my introduction, Alan, faculty members at colleges and universities all across this country have been disciplined and fired and lost classes over statements they've made or protests they've attended condemning the Israeli-U.S. war in Palestine. And a couple of months ago, you gave a talk at a symposium at the University of Michigan in defense of Professor Mara Finkelstein of Muhlenberg College, who I think was the first tenured college professor in the country to be fired for her anti-Zionist and pro-Palestinian speech. So please tell us the facts of her case and why you claim it's an example of the attacks on academic freedom that we're going to discuss here today on Law and Disorder.
Well, there's a lot of details about the case that first came out in The Intercept. So somebody might Google Mara Finkelstein, The Intercept, and they will get a lot of details. But the essential point is that she sort of triggered the investigation into her situation by posting something on, I guess it was called Twitter, maybe it was by then called X, which was a poem by a Palestinian poet, a rap poet, which had some provocative language in it about shame Zionists and calling Zionist names and so on. She just posted the poem without comment. And this was caught by somebody who was monitoring her, either it was Instagram or X, and reported. And then that sort of triggered an investigation into any prior complaints as to whether in her classroom she had said things that had bothered students or in some other situation. And it did come up that she had previously posted negative remarks about the attempts of students on her campus, which is Muhlenberg College. It's a small college in New Jersey. There is a large pro-Zionist contingent there. They were raising funds for the IDF there, and they had a table, and she had complained about it on the internet. And then it came up that a student had simply complained about her being in the building because apparently, as I understand it, the Hillel, which is has a relationship to many colleges and universities as the home for Jewish students, even though it's not a real academic unit. And Hillel has an awful lot of influence, and Hillel is also very biased. They do not allow students with anti-Zionist views to participate. So there was, for a while, there was an alternative Hillel set up. In any event, the Hillel office seems to be in the same building as Mara. So a student in the Hillel office complained that he was afraid to be in the same building with Mara because she'd made these anti-Zionist speeches, which he regarded as threatening. And that was sort of the trigger. And they began to meet with her and threaten her. And then they decided that they would suspend her. And then they announced the equivalent of firing. I don't know exactly what the term used was. And it's not complete yet. She's not allowed to teach. And she's not allowed to use campus facilities and so on. And there seem to be some appeal processes. So one thing about dealing with universities that you may know is they don't release a lot of information. They claim that, well, it's a personnel issue. We don't speak on personnel. So we don't know everything that they have against her. But it's generally that kind of thing, which is very typical to many of the other cases, although there are variations. I don't know whether you follow all the cases. There are so many, and there are new ones every day. But, for example, the Steve Thrasher case at Northwestern University is interesting. He's an important professor at in journalism there. And he apparently participated, well, instead of observing a demonstration, which many faculty members do, but participated in sort of setting up a protective line between the police and the students. And they've charged him with obstructing an officer because he participated in this protective line. And they've suspended his classes and they announced they're going to investigate his social media. There's also the case of Richard Heyman. He's a lecturer at UT Austin, so he was fired, but he wasn't a tenured faculty. He was an 18-year lecturer, which, you know, it's a substantial investment in UT Austin. The police claim that at a demonstration, he shouted expletives and then made a threatening gesture with his water bottle, which I gather is a pretty dangerous weapon, you know, up against a cop with a gun and a club and a shield and a water bottle. There's also Ruha Benjamin. She's a professor of African-American studies, very prominent. She's a MacArthur Fellow at Princeton University. Princeton has announced they're investigating her simply for her pro-Palestinian activism. Then you probably know about Catherine Frank. She's a Columbia University law professor. And she was on a radio show, one of your competitors, called Democracy Now! And she expressed concern that there are former Israeli soldiers studying at Columbia, and there had been an incident where some of these soldiers were accused of spraying student protesters and demonstration. And so she's now been threatened with the possibility of dismissal, and that's undergoing investigation. I could give you another bunch of names and so on, but that's the kind of thing that's happening around the country.
Well, Alan, talk to us about why you think that these, what you call witch hunts that are being carried out now, are reminiscent of witch hunts in the past. What common threads and common reasons are there for these attacks?
I think there are a lot of common threads. Other people have probably used the analogy. I'm drawn to it because I've done a lot of research in the 50s. I have my position here at Michigan is a chair named after H. Chandler Davis, who went to prison for refusing. He was a math professor, went to prison for refusing to cooperate and naming names, and eventually had to get his career restarted in Canada. There's no perfect analogy, but obviously the repression in the 1950s had to do with the international political situation. The government was trying to discipline the population to go along with the Cold War. And today it's also an international political situation. The government is trying to discipline the public to accept its support of the Israeli genocide, which of course is horrific and should be opposed. Another similar feature is the universities being a main target. They always see, well, first of all, universities are places where students and everybody protest a lot, and the vanguard of the Palestinian protests, obviously, on the campuses. But they can accuse the faculty of subverting and undermining and so on at the universities. Another similarity is the way that the federal government sort of triggers the situation by carrying out an investigation. So in the 50s, the post-war period, they sent FBI agents to the campus and they alerted the presidents of the campuses that they were going after lists of faculty. They had the names. And here you saw the congressional hearings in, I guess, in April, where the college presidents were brought on up and so on. So the federal investigations trigger this, and then the universities jump into action on their own and follow up. And of course, in both cases, they're aided by right-wing citizens who often put out lists of names. You've probably heard of red channels in the 1950s, which list the names of all kinds of people, professors and others associated with the left, with communism. And today we have things like Canary Mission, which is only one of four or five different listings you can find online, which has hundreds of professors' names and calls them anti-Semites. And the proof is that they support the boycott divestment movement and so on. And then in addition to those, there are larger books that publicize the supposed subversives, the famous J. Edgar Hoover book, Masters of Deceit. Well, today you have the Heritage Foundation has a book called Project Esther, which has it's like a hallucinatory fever dream that there's a Hamas-led terror network throughout the United States funded from abroad and so on. And in both cases, also similar is that the attack on the radicals is just a wedge to attack academic freedom and activism in general. There's a wedge issue. So in the 50s, the wedge issue was communist affiliation. And today, the wedge issue is alleged anti-Semitism. This gives people leverage, gives the right leverage to make a broader attack against broader things. And at present, it's, of course, the DEI, the Diversity, Equity, Inclusion programs that have replaced affirmative action. They want to destroy those. At the same time, keep in mind there are some differences. The 1950s witch hunt was not focused on current behavior. You know, today the accusations involve somebody making a statement like Mara Finkelstein on the social media, or claims that there's indoctrination going on in a classroom with critical race theory, or they're creating a hostile environment, or your course syllabus is not right. In the 50s, there was some investigation into your past, whether you signed a petition in support of Spain or something, but it was mainly about whether or not you had had some earlier affiliation with the Communist Party. They talked about conspiracy and espionage. They never proved that for a single faculty member, but they got them to on the stand and tried to show that they in the past had been connected with communism. Very few were still members. And then they did give them an escape route. You could escape the charge if you started naming names of other people and got them in trouble, and that would prove that you were no longer connected with communism. It wasn't enough to say, okay, I was, but I left, blah, blah. You had to go farther and prove it by naming names. I don't see that escape route at present. I mean, some of the people who've been accused of saying things on Instagram or whatever have sort of backed down and apologized, maybe, or they said they didn't mean what's being attributed to them. But that hasn't really gotten them off the hook. They're still being investigated. I think what disturbs me most about the parallels is that, you know, one happened earlier, so you would think that we would have learned the lessons, what you should do and not do. And it doesn't seem like people have learned lessons, because the pattern is so far similar. You get a sign from the federal government, and then the administration jumps in and starts censoring people and so on. And most faculty members just run for cover. You know, they don't want to get in the line of fire. Others sort of pre-capitulate, which is a pretty dangerous thing. I mean, that's what brought Hitler to power, and that's what brought the 50s witch hunt, as you just give in too early and go along with it. The main forces that are opposing it right now that I see are the American Association of Universities Professors, which is playing a pretty good role, the Middle East Studies Association, also an excellent role, and some local faculty, staff, Palestine Justice Committees, such as we have here in Michigan, is playing a pretty good role. But, you know, by and large, people are not standing up to this. So that's concerning.
Well, Alan, as I also said in my introduction, it's not only college and university administrations that are targeting pro-Palestinian professors for their behavior or their at a demonstration or their chanting of a demand or their writing or what they might say in a classroom. The federal government as well is also doing so, are they not? And in this regard, perhaps you could explain what Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 is all about and how it's being used really to censor or silence the pro-Palestinian professors on campus.
Right. I think Title VI is the main thing, but I don't want to ignore the fact that other things are happening. Universities are instituting a lot of new rules and policies about protests that we haven't seen before around supposed time and place restrictions. And of course, they're investigating course titles and syllabi and so on. But the Title VI thing is very important. Basic claim is Title VI, as you know, is under the Civil Rights Act. The argument is that you can't allow the harassment or discomfort of certain groups of people because it will interfere with their education. And so it's focused on the question of discrimination against a protected class. And it says that the protected class is due to race, color, or national origin. So they're claiming that when you attack a Zionism, you're attacking people of a national origin. That is, your anti-Zionist statement is not about politics, it's not about ideology, blah, blah, blah. It's really aimed at a protected class of national origin, which in the document that I've read, it says that refers to your country of birth or ancestry, as well as physical, cultural, or linguistic characteristics. So it seems to me kind of a stretch. I don't understand. First of all, they're claiming that if you attack Zionism, you're attacking Jews because somehow they're identical. That seems to me ridiculous, especially since most Zionists in the United States are Christians. I mean, the big movement is the Christian Zionists. There are 30 million of them. The total population of Jews is, you know, more like 5 million, probably not, you know, maybe three quarters of those consider themselves Zionists in a significant way and so on. So we're really talking about Christians when you talk about Zionists, but that's not the way they're treating it. The point is that if a claim is made under Title VI, which can be made by a student, a professor, a worker, and the university itself, if the claim is made that there's a harassment or hostile environment against this protected class, that is, in this case, Zionists, it can be punished because the government can take away millions of dollars of federal funding. You know, University of Michigan, it's like $12 million. So if the government wants to go after a university or college where there's some kind of radical activity, there's a financial incentive for the university administration to find some mechanism to punish people. Say, oh, no, look, we're expelling these people. We're censoring them. We're following Title VI and so on. And as we see, a lot of these violations have to do with complaining about social media and also complaining about the content of courses. That's becoming more significant. Apparently, they're trying to make it seem as if a Title VI violation can come from teaching a class we talk about Israel-Palestine in terms of settler colonialism, which is a very reasonable description of what's happened in Palestine. But they see this as an anti-Semitic critique, and they reinterpret this as supposedly meaning the annihilation of the Jewish population, even though the major theorists of settler colonialism, such as Rashid Khalidi, point out that, no, we're talking about a situation where two populations live in peace and equality. Removing the settler colonial aspect doesn't mean killing everybody who was involved in the settlement. And they also claim that this idea that the right of self-determination cannot take place when you're impinging on another population and kicking them out, that's an illegitimate self-determination, then you're saying that Jews don't have the right to self-determination, and they make that argument. So it's a combination of protesting against political critique and scholarship that they find threatening by announcing that it's anti-Semitic and harassing and creating an environment where students can't study properly, and therefore you have to censor.
Alan, I want to ask you about Zionism and what, in fact, is anti-Zionism. Is that anti-Semitic? We see that in central to the issues on college campuses, they're focusing on Palestinians' movement's attack on Zionism and the fact that Israel is a Zionist nation. And the movement's speech condemning Zionism is being equated with anti-Semitic speech. New York University has gone so far as declaring Zionist students and other Zionists a protected class on the NYU campus. And anyone condemning Zionism has been violating the rights of Zionist students. So can you tell us, what in fact is Zionism, and is the anti-Zionist position anti-Semitic?
Yeah, this is absolutely crucial that people have to understand what these are. I mean, first of all, what is anti-Semitism? Well, it's being debated, and people are coming up with definitions, different definitions. And some people are avoiding definitions, which is really problematic. But basically, it's Jew hatred. And Jew hatred has come in different forms. There's a common history, I think, that before the Dreyfus case in, 1894, Jew hatred was based on religious belief that Jews killed Christ and so on. After 1894, it was clear that Jew hatred was based on some kind of conspiracy theory, a racial conspiracy theory. And there was a big change then. It's not that the earlier type completely died out, but that it was predominated by a racial conspiracy theory, which, of course, the Nazis developed to the highest point. I should say that anti-Judaism is something a bit different. That's when you deny the Mosaic Covenant and you argue that it should be replaced by another theology, such as the Christian Covenant and so on. So what is anti-Semitism? Well, I think if somebody says, the Jews, can you put that on the radio? I don't know. Blank the Jews, that's anti-Semitic. And I think that if people make statements that promote the idea that there's a world Jewish conspiracy, or negative generalizations about Jews, such as Jews have control over the governments of the world and media and banks and so on, or if you have, anti-Semitic symbols, such as the kind of caricatures that the Nazis put out, or anything linking Jews to the blood libel, that, the belief that Jews like to kill non-Jewish children to have blood for their matzah, which, as I know, seems strange, but that was a widespread belief. And things that minimize the number of Jews died in the Holocaust. There weren't that many, just a couple or something. So, if a statement advocates or promotes violence against a Jewish person as a Jew or a Jewish institution simply because it's Jewish, I think that's clearly anti-Semitic, as well as, assaulting, harassing, or threatening a person simply because you visibly identify them as Jewish because of the clothing they're wearing or some alleged physical feature and so on. But Zionism is something different. Zionism is a political mission of state-making that gives an advantage to Jews. So when you think of anti-Zionism, it's basically a political opinion. You're against a supremacist state. And you're not talking about Jews or Judaism. You're talking about a kind of state. And when people conflate the state argument as being a core belief in being a Jew, that's, basically a fallacy. They seem to think you can't be against Zionism unless you're somehow against Jews as Jews. Now, of course, simply being an anti-Zionist and that doesn't explain all of a person's politics. I mean, most of the people in the United States that I work with and people I admire, like, let's say, Khalidi or Edward Said and so on, they were for something. They were for a democratic state, for example, in a region. Some people think that maybe two states or some kind of federation can achieve equal rights. I don't know if that's possible at present. However, if you are arguing for a Jew-free region where all the Jews are chased out or killed simply because that's something else. You're linking something else to the anti-Zionism, but that's not anti-Zionism itself. We have to be careful that, you know, just because you're for something, it doesn't mean that you're something for something else. You have to articulate that something else. And I think it's really important for people to know the history of Zionism, because, I mean, I guess I'm very critical of those people who say, no, we can't debate the Zionists. We're normalizing it. If we enter debate, we're saying everything's equal or something. I think, you know, the case against Zionism is so strong, people should be confident that they can tell the history, because we know a lot about it. And just screaming that Zionism is racism or fascism, that's not going to change anybody's minds. But if you get them to read, I know this sounds heretical and shocking, but if you get them to read the basic books, there's sort of a consensus. Zionism didn't exist until 120 years ago. The Jewish religion appeared about 2,500 to 3,000 years ago. There's a big gap there. And when Zionism appeared, it was during a period of the rise of nationalism. It was a secular form of Jewish nationalism. The original Zionist founder, Herzl, was not religious. He was not interested in Hebrew. He was not interested in Yiddish. He wasn't interested in Jewish literature or anything. He just wanted to be normal. And he didn't like anti-Semitism. So he thought, if we guys have a state in Argentina, in Africa, or Palestine, you know, then we'll be respected. I mean, that was his basic idea. Anti-Semitism was an issue, but the response was kind of assimilationist, really, just to become like everybody else and have your own state. And it was generally rejected by Jews. There were other kinds of Jewish nationalism and so on that were almost as influential. And then it evolved when Herzl came on a scene, and he came up with a belief that he was religious, and he was motivated by theology, and he believed that Jews should relocate in Palestine, and that the Jews had this proprietary interest, although he wasn't advocating exactly colonization. He was just advocating a presence there. But then as you follow the history and the British take over with the Balfour Declaration, you see it is colonialism with a mother country in England sponsoring it. And then eventually by 1948, when a population breaks with England, it becomes a settler colonialism of a special kind, and evolves into, you know, the situation we see today. So I think that by studying the history of Zionism, we can convince people. But I think that just denouncing it without explanation isn't that helpful.
As you study that history, you learn that when the country of Israel was formed, people like Albert Einstein said, I don't want anything to do with Zionism. I won't be the head of the country, as you've asked, and so forth. Well, in any event, this is Jim Lafferty, along with my co-host Michael Smith, and we're interviewing at the moment Professor Alan Wald from the University of Michigan. Well, Alan Wald, sadly, we are just about out of time, but I would like to hear any brief final thoughts you have on the topic we've been talking about today. And most assuredly, please let our listeners know where they can find some of your books and writings, websites, whatever you might direct them to that would be helpful in them understanding the topic we've been discussing today.
Well, I mean, I think the first thing I would like to conclude by saying is we do need to organize and fight back. Collective action is the answer. Individuals can play a certain kind of role, but the political movement on the left has changed a lot since the new millennium with social media and so on. And we do see a lot of people participating simply by tweets and by Instagram and also, you know, by snarky remarks. And so I think we need national organizations that can unify people around clear political demands, and the demand should be against the U.S. government. and also on institutions with investments in the Israeli state. And of course, the demand should be to immediately stop funding and work for a permanent ceasefire and a just solution. I'm certainly not against people showing solidarity with Palestine and, you know, carrying Palestine flags and stuff like that. But the movement itself has to make demands on the government. And we need to promote also things like the BDS within that framework, the Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions movement. And we have to carry out educational activities about what is anti-Semitism really, and then the fact that it's growing on the right is the problem. And we have to train people to clearly and competently explain to the public what is Zionism, not just shout slogans. I think we also need to have a clearinghouse of lawyers that can defend the victims of repression and organize defense committees nationally and unite people. I think Palestine Legal and the ACLU are doing some of this, but I haven't really seen it on a local level, but I haven't really seen a national effort. Then there's the global dimension. I mean, there are people in different countries with the same kinds of concerns. We have to figure out ways to link up to these movements in other countries. I've been on a few Zoom meetings with people in England and Western Europe, but I think there has to be a lot more of that. And on the other hand, we have to discipline ourselves. It's not helpful for people to do individually disruptive things. I mean, sometimes you can disrupt in a clever way. And of course, there are circumstances where, like, if, you know, Netanyahu were to come to the United States, yeah, you'd want to disrupt that. But some of these small-scale disruptions are not helpful. And we know that just one or two people acting poorly or with a terrible slogan, you know, like we need more October 7th against Israel or something, you know, Israel deserves October 7th. I mean, that's not very helpful.
I appreciate what you've just said. Would you please then quickly tell us where people can learn more about this, find your books, find your writings and so forth?
Well, I've been writing articles for the Journal Against the Current, which gets circulated. They appear on Portside. I said some were just published by the British Labour Party, the Jews in the Labour Party, and stuff like that. I mean, they circulate on the internet. If you look up the topic and the name, you know, I tend to rely on 972, on Al Jazeera. This is good stuff in the London Review of Books. I like Adam Schatz's writings. There's a lot of good stuff out there. And of course, the Rashid Khalidi's books are terrific. There are a number of Palestinian scholars who are doing great stuff on this.
Thank you, Alan Wald, for being with us today here on Law and Disorder. It's been a pleasure to talk to you, to listen to your ideas and your views, and we encourage our audience to follow up with as you have suggested.
Okay, thanks. Glad to talk to you guys.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
The Department of Homeland Security was created in 2002. Trump has appointed Kristi Neer, the governor of South Dakota, to be its new head. The DHS has consolidated previously separated departments and brought into a single sprawling entity 22 pre-existing agencies. It became the nation's third largest government department. Today it has a budget over $100 billion and employs 250,000 people. Every danger is now conceived as a threat to, quote, homeland security. As governor, Neer sent South Dakota National Guard troops to Texas 8 times to fight what she called the Biden border crisis. Trump said, quote, she'll work closely with border czar Tom Holman to secure the border and will guarantee that our American homeland is secure from our adversaries, end quote. Neer said, quote, I look forward to working with border czar Tom Holman to make America safe again. With Donald Trump, we'll secure the border and restore safety to American communities so that families will again have an opportunity to pursue the American dream, end quote. In 2017, she supported the Trump travel ban on Muslims. In 2021, she opposed Afghan refugees coming into South Dakota. In her memoir, she wrote about how she shot and killed her 14-month-old dog, Cricket, because he was not a good hunter. Today, we interview the Philadelphia-based writer Arun Khanani, who moved from London to the U.S. in 2010. He has recently co-authored the pamphlet Homeland Security, Myths and Monsters. His books include What is Anti-Racism and Why It Means Anti-Capitalism? Also, he's written The Muslims Are Coming, and the third book he's recently written is called The End of Tolerance. A former editor of the journal Race and Class, Arun has been described by the Guardian newspaper as, quote, one of Britain's best political writers. Arun Khanani, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it's nice to have you. We're going to talk about the Department of Homeland Security today. Where did the Department of Homeland Security come from? What does it consist of? And what does it do?
Well, one of the reasons for us putting out this pamphlet is that a lot of people forget how the Department of Homeland Security actually came into existence in the early phase of the war on terror after 9/11. So the pamphlet is, in fact, a graphic booklet with amazing illustrations by the artist Anuj Shrestha, and it's co-authored with Mizu Ozeki, who also co-edited the longer book it's based on called Resisting Borders and Technologies of Violence, which was published by Haymarket this year. But the Department of Homeland Security was founded in November 2002 amidst that atmosphere of kind of paranoia and vengeance in the war on terror. It brought together three different issues that until then had been seen as separate: immigration control, counterterrorism, and emergency management. And it basically placed them all under the heading of this new term, Homeland Security, a newly invented word, that phrase that no one had really used before then. When it was created, it was the only new government department that, you know, it's actually still the only new government department that's been created this century. It absorbed 22 pre-existing agencies into this kind of single sprawling entity, now the third largest government department. And soon enough, all kinds of other issues were sort of absorbed into it. If you look at the website now for the Department of Homeland Security, the things it lists as working on, apart from the three main headings that I already mentioned, cybersecurity, identity theft, policing of protests, school shootings, climate change adaptation, white supremacy, migrant labor exploitation, all these things get absorbed into it, and all of them get given this kind of homeland security framing. It has a budget of $100 billion. It employs 250,000 people. What is the homeland? What is this thing that is being secured? Well, the 9/11 Commission defined the American homeland as the entire planet. So you get a sense of the reach of this department. Its aspiration is to turn every issue into a matter of national security and apply that logic across the whole world. When you examine closely what homeland security means here, you realize it means security for the corporations to roam the world accumulating profits, not security for ordinary people. The greatest safety threats that we face are things like climate change, things like pandemics, things like the social breakdown resulting from our failed economic system. And the DHS does nothing, of course, to address those dangers.
Arun, President-elect Trump has now nominated the person he wants to see running the Department of Homeland Security, Kristi Noem. What can you tell us about her background, her political background and such, and what might we expect from her as the head of the department?
Well, she has sided with fossil fuel corporations against protesters. She has supported the Islamophobic Muslim ban from the Trump 1 administration. She's opposed to refugees arriving in South Dakota, where she's been the governor. She said that there is an invasion coming over the southern border of the United States. So she has all the qualifications for the job of heading up the Department of Homeland Security. As a congresswoman and then South Dakota governor, she worked with the energy company TransCanada to get legislation passed in 2019 to clamp down on people who were protesting against the Keystone XL pipeline. You remember the movement there involving indigenous people especially. The great illustration of how the whole notion of homeland security works. There's no greater danger to our security than the fossil fuel corporations who are destroying our planet, and yet she works to protect those very corporations from any challenge.
Arun, Trump got himself elected scapegoating undocumented immigrants as if they were the cause of a lot of our troubles. He has promised that on day one, he'll institute massive roundups, incarcerations, and deportations. Talk about the Department of Homeland Security's role in all of this.
Yeah, well, you know, things are moving very fast. We don't know exactly what to expect, but I think we should take Trump at his word and plan and anticipate for a very aggressive attempt at mass deportations as soon as he takes office in January. And the agency that he will turn to implement that primarily is this Department of Homeland Security. With the vast resources that have been pumped into it since 2002 by both Republicans and Democrats. That's the kind of bipartisan infrastructure that is now available to the Trump administration to perform what, you know, could be a form of ethnic cleansing, right? Attempting to remove people on the basis of their ethnicity. Let's not forget that over the last four years, the DHS has already forced hundreds of thousands of people out of the United States against their will in the name of border control. When the Department of Homeland Security was created, it also included the creation of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE. Its powers had been built up through the 80s and 90s to be able to surveil, to detain and deport people. Every year, ICE arrests hundreds of thousands of people. So that's already happening, you know, ICE raids in people's homes, workplaces and neighborhoods. ICE is also a massive surveillance operation. You know, there's billions of dollars in contracts with tech corporations to gather and process data. There's something called the HART biometrics database that is central to that. Every fingerprint taken in every police precinct gets shared with the Department of Homeland Security. So in the name of protecting borders, we have this massive surveillance operation that affects all of us. All of that infrastructure is now part of the machinery that Trump can draw on. The existence of this whole attempt to surveil and round up people through ICE, through the Department of Homeland Security that's been there for decades now, has constantly over that time sent out this message, you know, that immigrants are these dangerous criminals, these terrorists who need to be treated with suspicion and ultimately with the violence of a deportation. And so that's all helped to create the atmosphere in which Trump's anti-immigrant politics has been successful and now leads to a situation where millions of undocumented people are living in fear that the government will force them out of their homes, separate them from their children, and transport them away for no other reason than their status.
Kanani, you've already described to us just how vast not only the resources but the reach, the mandate, if you will, of the Department of Homeland Security. Is that why you refer to it as a monster?
Yeah, it's the sheer size of it, you know, the way it absorbs all these disparate issues that seemingly have nothing to do with each other and merges them under this single heading of Homeland Security and transforms them into its own image of Homeland Security. The way it spreads its footprint around the world, the Department of Homeland Security spends a lot of resources to pressure other countries, especially in Latin America, to collaborate in its kind of global policing mission, to share data, surveillance, to construct infrastructures for controlling migration. So, you know, Mexico has been paid billions of dollars to police its southern border by the Department of Homeland Security. So now you have this vast infrastructure of immigration control in Mexico itself that's been built at the behest of the US. And then when you look at the way that with Homeland Security, when one security threat becomes less salient in the public mind. With the war on terror, that's kind of receded somewhat in the last few years as a theme of kind of public fear. There's always new threats that come in to replace the ones that have faded away. So it's this kind of constant regeneration of fear. We see the Department of Homeland Security like the Hydra monster from Greek mythology. So it has these multiple heads. When you cut off one head, another grows in its place, and it's constantly regenerating itself.
Talk about, please, the rejection by the Trumpers of any obligation of society to protect the vulnerable as embodied by the campaign against undocumented people in the USA.
Well, I think if we're going to understand something of how Trump has been able to get elected for a second time, we need to get quite deep into essentially like what it's felt like, I think, to be in the the world over the last decade or two. And if you think back to the 1990s, for example, this kind of heyday of, you know, what people call neoliberalism coming to dominance in the United States, where we were told that, you know, if we're all individuals competing with each other, we acquire resources through getting a good job, getting into student debt to be able to get a good job. And then, you know, we should be able as individuals to command the pleasures that the marketplace has to offer. And that's the way that society is organized. Well, since the 2008 financial crisis, only a wealthy minority have been able to live like that. That idea of what American society should be like has been in crisis since then. That crisis was exacerbated by COVID, because COVID was a reminder that we're not actually sovereign individuals. We're bound up in all kinds of relationships to each other that we depend on. And so I think all of these kind of events, the financial crisis, the kind of the pandemic, signaled to us that we are highly dependent on the state and highly dependent on society. These things that neoliberal ideology tried to tell us were just nothing but market transactions. And so to the neoliberal mindset, there's been this kind of return of the social that's been deeply shocking. And I think the far right has responded to that very effectively by presenting this sense that we're being forced to return to the social by saying, you know, here's a fantasy you can live out of getting back your individual sovereignty through the kind of nihilistic pleasures of racial and gender domination, all that stuff they talk about, you know, the anti-woke crusade that they're engaged in, is centered on that. And so they're presenting the return of the social as this kind of unwelcome claim on your willingness to care about other groups. They're saying, you know what, you don't need to care. Those obligations to those needier than you, you don't need to worry about them. And the refugee is, of course, the neediest, right? The person who's literally been forced to leave their community, their home, and and arrives in your country with nothing. You know, that's the ultimate symbol to be rejected for the far right, because that symbolizes precisely this fear that maybe we do have social obligations to each other. And so I think this is the key to it, that this kind of neo-fascism draws its sustenance from the neoliberal idea that we should reject social obligations, even as it is, you know, it thrives in the debris of a neoliberal culture, right? That where that belief is threatened. And that's really the power of the MAGA movement, I think.
Arun, you talk about and write about the role of race and how it's a dominant and manifest role that explains really the expansion of border infrastructure, military spending, the rise in police and budgets, and the building of more and more prisons. You argue that all of this really is justified by presenting, or attempted to be justified, I should say, by presenting Black, Muslim, and migrant cultures as by their very nature deficient. Talk to us about this.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you look at like why do borders exist, right? And we've seen the kind of infrastructure of borders, you know, the walls, the surveillance, the legislative powers, you know, all of that really has expanded dramatically since the 1970s. Unrecognizable if you think about how immigration was policed in the 1970s compared to now. And so that border infrastructure has expanded hand in hand with the kind of neoliberal form of capitalism that has existed over that period. The reason that we have borders, you know, I think is ultimately to do with the need to maintain a kind of global apartheid, a kind of global racial division of labor. If you look at the US-Mexico border, you know, the wage paid to a worker in manufacturing work on the US side of the border in Texas is five times what it is for the same job on the Mexican side of the border. So what that border enables is for a corporation to be able to move from the US side of the border to the Mexican side of the border and suddenly have a dramatic saving in its labor costs and therefore increase its profits. And the border makes that possible. So a lot of people on the left think that ultimately capitalists want to get rid of borders, but actually borders are very functional to corporate profits. At the same time, by creating that border, it creates an undocumented workforce within the United States that can be more heavily exploited than the rest of the working class within the US because it's undocumented and therefore subject to heavier policing and more easily controlled. And so, you know, in both those ways, I think borders are highly functional to global capitalism. Alongside that, you have the massive expansion of policing powers, the mass incarceration. You have the massive expansion of the US military over the same period. And I think all of those are in different ways also ways that racial capitalism organizes the division of the world's populations, right? And the way it justifies that is through these ideas that there's something about black culture that makes it more dangerous. There's something about Muslim culture that makes it especially predisposed to terrorism. There's something about the cultures of migrants that make them more prone to crime and disruption and so on, right? And so this kind of language becomes the way that it's justified. But what really drives it is these the need to manage a particular form of capitalism. You know, these infrastructures of racist policing, the military, the border, the carceral violence, they coexist with a certain language of cultural diversity. You know, so over the same time, we sort of have this language of celebrating cultural diversity, celebrating racial inclusion and so on. But in the end, those infrastructures end up undermining those appeals to tolerance and diversity and so on that liberals tend to make. And they act as charging stations for fascist movements, right? They give, you know, the existence of the borders, the existence of mass incarceration, of the military and so on, give fascist movements a kind of constant source of political energy they can absorb. So the war on terror, for example, you know, which again, enthusiastically supported both by Republicans and Democrats, was the seed from which you got a new crop of fascist movements in Europe claiming to oppose Islamization. It was the seed from which US support for Netanyahu has been cultivated. The war on terror supplied the building blocks for Trump's first presidential campaign. You remember, you know, he started out politically talking about how Obama was a secret Muslim and this kind of conspiracy theory about Obama. And then he moved on a couple of years later to the Muslim ban. The whole of his initial entry into being a viable presidential candidate was about Islamophobia. What Trump is about the war on terror coming home. The racism of the war on terror deployed abroad, then re-entering the United States in the form of anti-Muslim racism.
Yeah, that's a profound thought, Arun. You're listening to Law and Disorder Radio. I'm here with Attorney Jim Lafferty. I'm Michael Smith. We're speaking with Arun Kanati, who's just written Homeland Security, Myths and Monsters. It's co-written with Maizu Izeki, and it's illustrated by Andrew Shestra. It's a wonderful pamphlet. I urge you all to get it. Homeland Security, Myths and Monsters. Arun, how do we build power outside of the elections? We got Trump with the elections. What do we do outside of the elections?
I think the challenge we have at the moment is that we have had decades now of a neoliberal culture that has told us that we are individuals above all else. And we have buried the kind of collective values that animated the mass movements of a century ago, let's say. So we need to go back to scratch, back to basics, and start to demonstrate in practice that simple truth that as human beings, we can come together as equals and participate in jointly shaping our destiny through our social and political institutions. Like that experience of participating collectively as equals in shaping something is such a rare experience in a neoliberal era. But without it, we can't really get ourselves off the ground to build the kind of larger mass movements that we need, the kind of organizations that we need to be able to fight back against both the kind of neoliberal version of capitalism and the new kind of neo-fascist version of capitalism that might be emerging. And so, you know, what we need to be involved in an organization. We need to work with other people. We need to make those relationships meaningful. We need to seek changes at whatever level we can, which might be quite small at this point. It might be just in a locality. It might be at the city level rather than at state or federal level. But we need to have that experience of some kind of wins that we achieve collectively. And Maurice Bishop, the leader of the Grenada Revolution, said that organization is our greatest weapon. And in fact, it's our only weapon, but it's the only weapon we need. It can be just 30 people coming together. There's a kind of power in that that we need to rediscover.
Well, Arun, we are now getting short of time, sadly, but I guess the question then on our minds is, and should be on everyone's mind really always, I suppose, is what kind of a culture do we really need? Where do you find the faith in the kind of culture you think we need? What kind of values do we need? Your newsletter, you quote a description of values and how we need to restore loyalty, comradeship, generosity, a sense of community, and the like. Talk to us a bit about that. What is needed in order to overcome these divisions, if you will, and have a kind of shattered, scattered culture that we have today in this country?
In that newsletter, I draw on the Sri Lankan writer Sivanandan, who I think describes this very well. And he talks about how we need unity. And unity is not something that you just discover, you know, through a shared identity or a shared class position or something like that. It's something that you have to forge, and you have to forge it again and again and again. And you do that through loyalty, through finding something in other people's struggles that connect with your own, what he calls all the great and simple things that make us human. And I find, you know, that's where my faith comes from, even in these darkest of times, is what I know to be true of human beings, that if we live lives that are only about competition and domination, ultimately that's unrewarding. That doesn't satisfy the soul in the way that genuine human connection does. Socialism is nothing if it's not the organization of society to reflect our human need for being together. That's in the end the bedrock upon which everything else that we need to do can be built.
To that I say amen. It's been wonderful having you on Law and Disorder. Jim and I thank you. We want to ask you one final thing. How can people follow your work? How can they get your newsletter?
The easiest way is just to go to my website, which is mylastname.org. So that's KUNDNANI.org. And there'll be a pop-up on there for people to sign up.
Thank you very much, Arun. It's been a real pleasure for Jim and I to be able to talk to you today. You take it easy.
Thank you so much for having me.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.
A quick reminder, if you want to listen to Law and Disorder's podcast, one way to do that is visit lawanddisorder.org. There you'll see our podcast players now positioned at the bottom of each show's post. And there you can click on the three dots in the right corner of the player to either, well, download, subscribe, or visit the podcast page. Good, 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 good. That's great.